So Jim is going to do the honors. So Jim's request, this is like a formal ritual that we have in Theravada Buddhism for those of you who are kind of not used to that. And it's an ancient tradition, and I've learned it from Thailand. So Jim was making a formal request for a Dhamma talk, and then I was responding by paying homage to the Buddha and reflecting on the refuges. And it's one of the great good fortunes in my life is that I've had a chance to learn Buddhism in a very traditional culture, a very conservative culture, but a culture which produced a lot of very fine teachers and monastics and lay people who are very well accomplished on the path. Both the villagers around Wat Bapong and the monks around Ajahn Chah. So with many rituals, funeral rituals and blessings for weddings and rituals of forgiveness, rituals of sharing requisites, and rituals of taking dependence on a teacher, and so on and so forth. And there's a kind of richness in that that is bigger than any particular person. And you have these rituals which are not just invented in the moment, but it's something that are carried over 2.5 millennia. Something very, very rather wonderful about that. So some Westerners are interested in learning those things. I feel like I've got a neck brace on. there's a little book in my talks out which is called Contemplative's Craft, and so I thought I'd ponder that topic with you. Craft for me in that title has a double entendre. Craft both as vehicle and craft as skillful doing. And the cover of the book has someone in a canoe. So that was the double entendre. So when I came to Buddhism, I had a yearning for silence. So someone called, I'm going to say his mom actually, she's from Chennai, and she said, "You have a vocation for silence." And I kind of, yeah, that's true, that was my vocation. Because I didn't really sign up to be a Buddhist, and I didn't really sign up to be a monk per se, as some kind of a clerical vocation where I'm going to preach and now convert all of North America to Theravada Buddhism. That was not the intention, it's still not the intention, but rather I was looking for a format, a way of moving towards that vocation of silence, which I felt was essential to my own life's purpose, I suppose. And so I had the good fortune to meet a monk in India. I was living in a little place called Elmora, near the Nepalese border. I had longer hair, less wrinkles. It was a lovely, lovely place. And so he showed me the way of monasticism as a vehicle. Before that, I had a sense of what I had to do, but I didn't quite know how to do it. And so I had kind of dropped out of engineering at U of T, and I couldn't really get my teeth into anything because none of it was speaking to this vocation. Now I think I could do engineering and do it as a meditative thing. I won't. I don't need to do everything. But I can understand now how that would be possible. But at that time I didn't, so it was always, the references were always external, and they weren't answering that inner yearning I had, which I think came from childhood, really. So in terms of vehicle then, say this monk, we were going to go to Thailand together, and he disrobed, which was interesting. So here I was, and I kind of, oh, you can do that. He's the only monk I ever met. Disrobed, and I chickened out, and I stayed in India, and then got hepatitis, and then stayed some more in India, finally got out of India, and then I was working in Switzerland, and it came to me again what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to Thailand. So I flew to Thailand and just started to look for something. I didn't even know where Thailand was, barely. So anyway, to make a long story short, I ended up ordaining as a samanera, and then about 3 or 4 months later I met Ajahn Chah, and then I ordained as a monk with him. So when he, and this actually is the 100th year of the birth of Ajahn Chah, this 2018. So in all our monasteries throughout the world now, we've been having reflections, and his biography has been published. That's online if anyone is interested. And we had a big meeting at Wat Bapong, the main monastery, in January 16th. We had 1,200 monks, I think, 20 or 30,000 people. Now in June they had another meeting. So it's been a year of reflecting on Lopo Cha, on Ajahn Chah. And so in my reflections around that, to some extent just the kind of vehicle he created, it's hard for me to speak to lay practice because I can only offer you, say, how I have done it as a monk, because I never had a lay practice. I didn't know any lay groups, or had never done retreats, or barely knew what meditation was. And I just flew to Thailand and became a monk, because when I read it, I said, yeah, the man says be a monk, okay, let's go for it. And I was free enough to do that. And so I don't really have the insights of family, like what does it mean to raise kids, or what does it mean to have money, or what does it mean to have to deal with a mortgage, or what does it mean to be married in a relationship. I don't have the insights of that vehicle. That's a different vehicle, but it is a vehicle. So I can only share my own sort of limited understanding through this vehicle called monk. So I do monk, and you do what you do. So doing monk, the gift that Ajahn Chah gave was not, his being was a gift too. I mean, just seeing the man and being with him. You see, I want some of that action. Mm-hmm. I like this. He was a very, very happy man, but not silly, not frivolous, powerful, like a shogun, a very powerful man. And so his presence was frightening sometimes, in the sense that I hope he can't read my mind. Please, don't. His compassion was very, very profound, very, very deep. But his compassion could come out in very fierce ways. So you wouldn't mess with Ajahn Chah kind of thing. But what he did beyond his own practice and his own presentation of Dhamma, he created a vehicle. So Wat Bapong, the monastery that I started in, just had really, really good morality, good schedules, good relationships of senior and junior, good principles of sharing resources, good principles of receiving and accepting admonishment, morning meditation every morning at 3:30. If you want to meditate, meditate. If you don't want to meditate, meditate. That was your choice. And all of that was like a vehicle. You know, it was a structure which was, and then all the Vinaya rules, personal rules about, like the reflection you have around the meal, to be content with little, a kind of a reflective vehicle. So I was certainly not content with little, but the reflection allowed me to see my discontent. So rather than saying, you know, Viradhamma, you should be content. No, the reflection was, aspire to contentment with little by looking at discontent and abandoning the tendencies to discontent. And that's different, isn't it? It's a whole different way of operating. And so that contemplative or reflective way of presenting this lifestyle was so helpful. So certainly, you know, like the food thing, I think I was malnourished for the first 2 years. They tell me I was green in complexion. It's not good green. You know, you don't want to do green. I'm very thin, and so on. And yet, the food given was given the best the people had, and it wasn't impoverished, but it was, you know, it wasn't like I had lots of egg dreams. I remember, it's craving protein. But all the time, the reflection was, it's good enough. You make it till tomorrow. It's good enough to make it tomorrow. But my mom, I won't make it. And then you made it till tomorrow. So all the time, the reflection on contentment with little became a vehicle for looking at discontent. Right? And then the looking at discontent became the craft of the heart. So you have a vehicle which reflects back to the traveler, as it were, how things are, and how what you should consider, what you should look at. And then the craft of the heart is moving towards the wholesome and abandoning the unwholesome. So the whinging, complaining in my mind was definitely not being content with little, but it was there. It was definitely there. Yeah, I want more, I want more. And then all of a sudden, yeah, but it's good enough. It's good enough. It's good enough. And that helped me to awaken to the whinging mind, to the complaining mind. And once you're awake to something and you start to take responsibility for it, then that's the beginning of the end of that condition, because you're no longer believing and fueling it with ignorance. But it has longevity, unfortunately. You know, it has energy, because if I whinged and complained for X years before I became a monk, it wasn't going to stop all of a sudden, because it's a habit. It's a habit. And so I'd often go to Ajahn Chah, and not often, but enough. You know, I'd kind of despair at the pathetic nature of my own mind, and that my meditation was down the tube, and he'd say, well, what did you expect? You haven't trained your mind. Give it 5 years. Oh, come on. Well, it was true, wasn't it? And I had trained my mind, I just had habits of mind. He said, just stay in the vehicle. Just, you know, just sit in that seat and watch the way things are. So morning meditation, liking it, not liking it, not wanting to go, not wanting to, but going and going and going. Evening meditation, mosquitoes biting, I don't want to be here, yeah, but I'm here. And just staying with it. Long discourses, they were quite, there was one I remember, one of those long, in the early days Ajahn Chah had this kind of capacity to give like 2, 3, 4, 5 hour talks. I mean, I find half an hour like difficult. So, you know, this is going on and on and on. And you know, I could concentrate for about half an hour, then my tie would fall apart. And after a while, I realized he's playing with us. he's and, you know, you'd watch, you say, well, shut up. Go meditate. Wait a minute, this is meditation. And everything's so whining and complaining, and he's just going on and on. And every day. And every day. And then you watch, oh, discontent feels this way, discontent feels this way, until finally you'd say, I give up. It's only pain, it's only discomfort. And then the peace would settle, but the conditions were the same. It was the same concrete floor. It was the same long not understanding what's going on. But the peace of the mind began to settle in because of the reflective. So the vehicle was like the evening meditation, and not even understanding the language of the vehicle. That's where I'm gonna learn about this now. I've got a chance now to learn about my discontent and complaining mind. And just watch and watch and watch until finally the power of that discontent and complaining eased away, and the power of mindfulness or awareness began to dominate. And then when the mind wants to go there, no thanks. But it wasn't becoming someone who didn't have discontent. I never find that works. It's just an idealism. It was more like knowing discontent and not investing anything in it. That's different. That's much, much different. So this vehicle of called monk then became, for me, with all its disciplines and its routines and protocols, became a way for me to look at the kind of major themes in my own heart, and the major themes of suffering and the end of suffering, which I could now learn, because now I had the freedom to observe, whereas before I had the freedom to change things. And that wasn't the freedom, because I'd been traveling for 3 years. I'd been in Europe and North Africa, and then I went across from Turkey through Afghanistan to India, and I was in Goa, and you know, all those things that one did in those days, which were, they're not in my biography, let's say. But they weren't edifying. They were distracting. So I had the freedom to do all of that, but I never really looked at the way things were. Now I didn't have the freedom. The vehicle really contained me. It's a very tight vehicle. It's basically either a two-person kayak or a one-person kayak. Monasticism, and there's not much option. And that's just what I needed. I need to be trapped in a good situation, with good teachers and a good society. It was not immoral, but I need to trap myself voluntarily and observe the way things are. So now I have the freedom to watch, rather than the freedom to reorient and reorganize my life. And I think I understood that intuitively, because I had done the other, traveled around the world and done stuff. So I realized, and of course, I had this very marvelous teacher who just kept encouraging me through all my doubts and difficulties. So that vehicle part of the craft, I don't know for lay people, right? I don't know like what the vehicle of being a monk is. Powerful vehicle, right? Like with my mom, caring for my mom, I always knew I could never love her as much as she loved me. I just felt there was a sort of difference, but I really loved her deeply. I just felt there's something different. And that I can't understand, because that's not part of my vehicle, neither right nor wrong. Being a parent, say, having kids, it's abstract for me. I think it's a tough vehicle from what I've heard, a very rewarding vehicle, but it is a vehicle, isn't it? It's like, now, children, this is what I'm practicing in, these responsibilities and whatever comes up. So the vehicle for lay people was always, it's kind of vaguely defined through 3 to 5 precepts, the moral precepts, through mutually caring relationships, father to son, son to father, mother to son, son to mother, teacher to pupil, pupil to teacher, husband to wife, wife to husband, employer to employee, that kind of, mutual caring, from an Indian society, but that was very much part of the way the Buddha talked about the lay vehicle, and how to practice as a lay person. But then the practice of the craft is, the craft of the heart is the same, isn't it? It has to be. So the vehicle's different. We have different haircuts, or you wear blue, I wear brown, and you have whatever you have. So the more I think the one can clearly have clear boundaries and clear definitions of what one is in the world, social definitions, that can be very, very helpful. And then to give up to those and give to those the best one can. why I think it's really important to have lay teachers to talk about the things which are part of lay life, you know, like to talk about parenting or like just the use of money. You know, that must be a really very difficult one. Right? We have treasures that deal with that kind of stuff. So I think now in the modern context of Buddhism, it's very, very helpful that we have these different teachers maybe talking from different vehicles in very, very good ways. So you have your monk. But the craft of the heart, and that's not different, is it? Because we're all the same that way. We all want to be free from suffering, and we all have different conditions and things that we're challenged by. So my second teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, he really kind of, Lompa Cha inspired me and gave me that structure and pushed my buttons a few times and so on. Ajahn Sumedho very much kind of molded my practice and helped me very, very personally. And I'm not very well read in scripture. I mean, I know how to read, but I'm much more an oral person. Like I've gotten a lot of teaching from, because I've had very, very good teachers in that way. So Lompa Sumedho has been very, very helpful, influential. And one of his main themes is to make things conscious. And one of his early themes was consciousness is the escape hatch. Consciousness is the escape hatch. So when things are conscious and they're known as an object, then they don't fester in the heart. They don't go back into the heart. So if I feel resentment towards someone and I make resentment fully conscious within the vehicle of right speech, right, within the vehicle of social responsibility, I feel resentment towards someone, and the resentment feels this way, allow it to be fully conscious as an object, then resentment is liberated from the heart. If I don't, then the resentment comes up, and if I act on it with speech which is hateful, I reinforce some form of aversion. Or if I think I shouldn't feel resentment, then I push it down with some idealized sense of self, and it's not liberated. It keeps festering, keeps coming up. So that was one of the things that he really encouraged me. You know, let this be conscious, be fully conscious of the way things are. And so, as I was saying to June, I think, one of my, like, the early years of meditation, boy, I could be angry. I didn't know about what, but it didn't matter. Give me something to be angry about. I hate this monster. And I go to Ajahn Sumedho and I said, well, should I do metta bhavana? Should I love all sentient beings? I said, don't be silly. Just swear. Make it conscious. Of course. You know, I won't do it because this is recorded. But and I walk up and down and oh, yeah, anger feels this way. So now it's conscious, right? And I can see it in the body, I can see the narratives, and that's a memory, memory feels this way. But before that, I was kind of coming from an idealized place that all monks are loving, you know, love everyone all the time, especially their fellow monks. Oh, you kill the monk next to me, make it conscious. But conscious, it does not mean you have to express it, does it? Like you don't have to go and punch the person in the head. It's just, no, rage feels this way. And it's very uncomfortable to feel that. So my most profound use of that has been around, as I often talk about, around fear and anxiety. And that's been the major part of the craft of the heart for me is fear and anxiety. And I say this in most of my talks, so please excuse me if you listen to my podcasts and so on. But I was so anxious as a kid when the phone rang, I'd run into the cupboard. I'm not good. I never do with an iPhone, would I? I was really shy. I was really, really shy. Very, very frightened. So then, being a monk in Thailand, it was fun. Because I was a junior monk and I could be shy and not even know I'm shy. I'm going to meditate. Leave me alone. Then, they shipped me out to England. And guess what? Ajahn Sumedho's not there. And I'm the senior monk. I have to give the talk. And I'd have this incredible fear, because now I had to give the talk. And the fear was not logical. It was not rational. It was more in the guts. So it was very good for cleaning out the bowels. It had a purgative quality to it, if you know what I mean. But it was so strong, and the self-consciousness was so strong, but I stayed in the vehicle. And the vehicle now, being a monk, was giving talks. Now my mind, and I said, that's not the deal. Monks, 10 years. You get 10 years of that, and no, sorry. So I was a monk for 3 years or 4 years, and Ajahn Sumedho said, well, go and give the talk. What would I say? I said, it doesn't matter. You probably know a little bit more than them. So then I began to make conscious fear. Oh, fear feels this way, because it was now, it had the conditions for it to come up, and that was actually really the best thing for me. But if I hadn't put myself in that vehicle, no way I would have done that. And I would just, you know, probably be kayaking on the top of North Island or somewhere. So then the fear became the object of awareness in the craft of the heart. So first I'd like plan my talks, and I'd go blank, which would make more fear. And Ajahn Shah said, no, don't. Rinpo Sumedho said, don't plan your talks. There's a lovely story of Rinpo Sumedho once, one of his first talks in Thai, and he plans it all out, and does a really intellectual talk, and lay people are praising him. And you know, he thinks he's done pretty well, but it's all been planned out. So he didn't have to face his fears or whatever it was. And then Bodhisattva says to him, don't ever do that again. So although the praise was there, he wasn't coming from the place of the heart. He was coming from a place of preparing, and then not that that's wrong, but Ajahn Chah suggested, no, just come from your heart. So anyway, for me, then the practice became actually quite simple in that way, although the conditions were very unpleasant, right? It was really like an emotional enema before the talk. frightened and fearful, and the lips would be quivering, and more body awareness. And then we had to investigate, what's the problem with fear? You know, what is it about anxiety? And I realized it was the fear of fear. It was the not wanting of anxiety, because it's so unpleasant, so terribly unpleasant. And I began to see how the Four Noble Truths now apply to my own conditioning and to my own craft of fear and the desire not to have the fear. And that investigation took a long time. And I had to have the fear to come up to see that the fear wasn't the problem, that was natural. Certainly unpleasant, but it was natural because I wasn't doing it. If I was doing it, then I wouldn't have done it. I just say, no, I don't think I'll do fear today. But that wasn't the option, right? And so there it was. And it came up according to causes and conditions. So whatever karma I had, I don't know. And so I began to see, okay, it's not. And it took, you know, and this is the contemplative mind. Contemplative minds constantly say, okay, this is the way it is now, what's the problem? It feels like this, what's the problem? And the reflection is around the Four Noble Truths. That the problem is desire to have something else, or not to have this, and that the letting go of that desire is the solution. It's not the unpleasant condition itself, it's the desire not to have the unpleasant condition, right? And that took a long time to figure out, because even though I had the formulas and I had studied the books and so on, it was so visceral, and you know, I had, you know, responded to fear in very shy kind of ways for so many years. It wasn't apparent at all, not at all. But then having to be in that, what's the problem? What's the problem? It's the fear. And then I go back to the Four Noble Truths. Cause of suffering. There is suffering. Okay, yeah, okay, I agree. This is definitely dukkha. This hurts. And then what's the cause? The cause is attachment to desire. Okay, what's the desire around the fear? And that's what I mean by the contemplative mind. And I'm not just analyzing, I'm in situ, I'm using some framework that the Buddha has offered us. I'm using that framework now to look at the problem. And even though I understand the craving around food, that was easy to understand actually. The craving around fear, that was much more difficult to understand. So I had a kind of normal lesson around food and was kind of content with whatever was offered, but with fear it was much, much more profound, but the pattern was the same. Why are you suffering? Why are you suffering? What's the problem? This is the way it is now. And then I began to see it's not about pleasure and pain, it's about the wanting. Again, start to get a hold of that peace. And as I saw that, oh yeah, there's the wanting, I began to move the mind to openness. And that's why these ideas of it all belongs are very important for me. That metta bhavana, or the practice of kindness, is not just having kind states of mind, it's accepting into consciousness the whole shlamazel of what you've got, the whole peace, whatever it is. And then I saw that that made metta bhavana, or the practice of kindness, something more than just may I be well, may you be well. It got beyond dualism. It got to the point of more instrument of consciousness. Things arise, causing conditions, and if the mind can remain open to that, it recedes into the silence, and that began to touch my vocation. I said, that's okay, that's what I can do with this fear. I can return to the silence of knowing. And then that, again, it's, you know, I can say it in a few sentences, but it was, you know, quite a few years of just struggle, but always in the vehicle. Okay, this is a I don't want it. No, I don't want it. I don't want it. No. And I had one Rajan. I had to second Rajan Sumedho on a retreat. I've been a monk for 4 years. He was doing a 10-day retreat, and he was called away halfway through the retreat, and all of a sudden I have to teach it. I forgot the Namo Tassa. I couldn't. This is not good. And then I'd been monk for like 4 years, right? But there it was. I struggled through and so on. And of course I have a strong self-disparaging mind, right? So that really helped. So the whole combination of things, but I stayed with the vehicle. This is the vehicle, okay? And then, now I look back on it, I said, gosh, am I grateful for that. But if I'd been, you know, if you would give me an option, no way. And I think that's the importance of sadhyaka, which is bigger than our own design. I mean, the body's health is bigger than our own design. That's one thing. Yeah? Aging is bigger than our own design. So then in that piece of like, say, feeling anxiety, I began to really welcome it. Really kind of, I know that would have been a strong word for me at the beginning of this. I thought, no. Each time it comes up, it's a chance for purification. You know, each time I can make this, it comes out, yeah, okay, let's have it. I realized that this is the cessation of fear, not through its neglect, but rather through its knowing, and through the full consciousness, fear feels this way, fear feels this way. And to do that, what did I have to do in stream of consciousness? I had to be kind, right? So in stream of consciousness, the conditioned habit was fear and anxiety, but then what I was putting into it was kindness and openness, kindness and openness, kindness and openness. So kindness and openness began to be the dominant theme. Fear and anxiety were no longer fueled. I wasn't putting fuel on it because I wasn't adding to the narratives. It's just this way. Body awareness feels this way, whatever. And then I would do metta bhavana, may all beings be well, and so on. So in stream of consciousness, the causes for openness and loving kindness were being generated, and the causes for more fear and anxiety were being abandoned. And so the result is, ta-da! Sorry. But no, you know, like I'm enjoying this. And I wouldn't have enjoyed this 30 years ago, right? I would have, don't crucify me, please. And I mean, those are the results we're looking for, I think, right? You can have some abstract result about enlightenment and all of that, but what we want to do is be free here, I suspect, no? And when the practice works in that way, then you have a real kind of confidence in the basic tools that you're using, these tools which work, and then they become even more profound. So these kind of tools that I like, these kind of contemplative tools which I sharpen and use, in themselves they become more and more simple. So language becomes a more and more simple self-coaching or self-direction. Like, so I use simple language like non-becoming. You know, when I put that into conscious and non-becoming, then if I'm tending to try to get something in my meditation, that's the mirror for this striving of the mind. Non-resistance, and I get to have pain in the body, and I decide to sit. Non-resistance, and I see the resistance to pain. So this is the contemplative. And the language is very simple, it's not analytical, but it is using thought, and I would say that's what one of the things we mean by right thought. Thought which is like a mirroring or a suggestion. And that's what I suggest to people, and you have some sort of insight into what you're working with. If you can find a word for it, and then introduce that word into your life, then that word reminds you of the insight, reminds you of how non-grasping might work. But it's not trying to recreate the experience. That's different. If I'm trying to recreate the experience, that's desire. I want to come into the present moment, but in an attitude which is imbued with the collected insights that I have and you have, right? And I would say that's what intuition is. Intuition to me is an accumulation of wholesome insights which deepen my sense of the way things are, right? And it's hard to define that, isn't it? And then I would say each of us, when we meditate, what you bring to the meditation is all your failures. Because those failures show you, no, it's not there, it's not there, it's not there. And that's the sort of intuitive process. So if I think about my own process, my early years are very determined, you know, very willful. And if someone says I should be more willful, I just look at them. Yeah, go for it. But I've been there, done that. And I know my intuition knows, no, that's not good for me. And that is very important, that we honor our own insights and wisdoms, shall we say, of accumulated practice, which is not really an idea. It's like a sense of what works, what doesn't work, what's appropriate, what's dharma. My own inspiration in sort of kind of vocation of stillness is very much around the language of enlightenment in Theravada Buddhism, and so I use that a lot. So the reflection that the Buddha gives us, that there is the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unborn, the deathless, the harbor, the island, peace, nirvana. I don't use nirvana much because it's a corrupted word. I think it's a perfume or a spa or something like that somewhere. So the language gets kind of contorted by popular culture, so I don't use that one. But I know this, unconditioned, uncreated, unborn. I love that language, deathless, unoriginated, unmanifest, peace, the island. So when I go through that language, and I say, well, where's the heart in that? You know, where's the heart in that? And it can sound very, very dry. It's not. And then I return to the Brahma-viharas, these divine abidings that the Buddha said are the manifestation of a liberated heart. And that's the way of empathy, isn't it? It's the way of kindness, is the way of not dwelling in ill will. So it's the basic feeling of goodwill. That doesn't mean I have to like everyone, right? But it's goodwill, and goodwill is like wishing even beings that I dislike and distrust and who are nasty and mean and so on, may they be free from suffering. Not that I like them or even trust them, but it's like goodwill, right? And that we can do. And that's a kind of empathy where we feel, yeah, all beings really want to be free from suffering, empathy. And then karuna is that sense of compassion and empathy we have for people who are maybe less well off than us, or sick, or in trouble. And that's a possibility, compassion. And you think about when empathy comes up, it comes up when the mind is receptive. And when you're receptive, then you're in tune with the other person. And then joy is that the empathy of goodness. So the feeling a mom has when her, you know, like, I think as a kid in like, must have been like grade one or two, I sewed one of those pin cushions for mom, right? She still had it. And I can imagine her, right? You know, this little tight, little blonde-haired kid comes, hey, look at this. And the joy she would have had at that. And that's the empathy of joy, of goodness, and mudita. And then upekkha is the kind of empathy with dharma. It's a sense of that all things belong, and that in this realm of sense contact, there is both good and bad, success and failure, good times, bad times, good fortune, misfortune, good health, bad health. This is a dual world that has both. And equanimity is the peaceful coexistence with all that. And came from my mom, the first three were easy. You know, I always wished her goodwill. I always felt for her suffering. And when she was happy, I was really happy. But equanimity is very, very hard. When she felt pain, it was hard for me not to worry. And then she would kind of not try to show her pain because she was worried about me. So it was a lovely kind of way of relating. So there is the heart. There is the heart. And I think I enter into that more, as I was saying earlier, into this sort of receptive quality. Because if I can receive and say that my own annoyances belong, it belongs, but then the other person that I'm annoyed at also belongs, then my heart comes to that openness. Yet if I think that compassion is like never having thoughts of annoyance, I'm finished, I'm toast, can't do it, I am by you, hands up kind of thing. And that, you know, so when I come to that, then I say, yeah, the openness is not, and that's what metta means. Intellect divides and chops up, and the open heart includes all things. And we have both, you know, we have both those possibilities. So there's some ideas. Maybe we could, we have a chance for any questions if anyone has, or comments around that. That's another ritual we do where one of the listeners then says, good on you, mate. It's a Kiwi translation. Any thoughts or comments around that? I just have some water first. Any questions? Yes. Medawi, okay.
On the question of willfulness and distinguishing an energy that can be adhitana but not willfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, even in your story about saying something that might have hurt someone, you definitely had remorse, you could watch the mind moving into guilt, and you'd say, no, that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because, like, when the mind starts to go down that unwholesome track, it's got that energy to do that. I mean, that's how it feels in my body as it starts. And something quite definite has to pull it back from that avenue and no, here. Now, is that willfulness?
Sure, yeah. As long as it's not conjoined with craving. You know, when you understand something, you can shift attention without craving, or you can shift your attention with craving. So when my mind starts to create self-narratives, I try to shift it back to non-narrative, but not from the desire to get anything, more from the experience of awakening. So I return to awakening, rather than try to get rid of thinking. That took a long time, too. You see the difference?
I'm just trying to feel into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to sort of use the becoming language, too. So mm-hmm. this feeling of becoming as I'm picking up the, let's say, the unwholesome pattern, and the decision to not follow that.
If I may phrase it differently, I would say the self-narrative is a contraction, and that the movement away from that contraction is the opening, so it's a relaxing. So the movement from the remorse to the guilt was in thought, was a contraction, and then the awakening response is an opening away from that contraction. That's another way to look at it.
And that makes so much sense as a result, and I can imagine as you get more practiced in it, that can almost be an immediate response.
Very much.
But in more early stages, where there's that strong desire to follow the habit that you know is not skillful and not going to bring you, it feels like the energy of shifting is...
less subtle?
Yeah, and with a more of a no.
No way, Jose. Now those are things you learn, right? In your own, because on the other hand, if a person is like just very laissez-faire, well, it's all right. I'll just complain, right? And has no self-awareness, then you know a different suggestion might work. But for me, the self-narrative is always a contraction. If it's a self-narrative which is functional, you know, do I have to go to the dentist and so on and so forth? That's different. But when it becomes imbued with self-view, that contraction into thought and me and minus becomes very, very painful. It's dukkha, right? And my intuitive response is to open without repression, without saying it should be that way, because it just feels right and open and is loving and so on. And that is training. It's very much a craft, I think. You know, the things, because I think the avenues of our suffering aren't that many. You think about it, you know, the ways I suffer is, you know, three or four, but they're the same ones. And then you say, oh yeah, it's the same one, it's just, this once it was around Charlie, now it's around Fred. But it's actually the same thing, and you got to get, oh yeah, okay, that's that. It's not only about Charlie and Fred, right? It's this patterning, you know, and then you get really good at it. Because you're not fooled by the objective circumstances of it, right? And you know, it's like kind of like honing a craft. You know, you just get really, really good. Just keep working that piece of wood. Yes?
Well, first of all, thank you. I listened to your YouTube talk about fear.
Okay.
Well, I'm a friend in England and said to me, you have to listen to this every day.
So I have to.
Anyway,
here we go again.
Well, you know, fear is, it's a frequent visitor for me, and particularly in the last year or so. And well, it has been all my life, but then it had a real eruption. And so I'm just noticing with it, and you know, that it's tricky, and it comes up with new things throw at me. So I think I'm okay. I'm gonna be with this. I'm gonna be with this. I'm gonna be with this. And then all of a sudden, I'm completely in it again, and being terrified by what it's bringing up. Either usually it's both a combination of mind, emotional, and physical, and then these days it's palpitations, really strong palpitations all the time, frequently all the time. So I think to myself, backing up, I guess what I don't know what my question is, just when I'm noticing I'm already in it, like, okay, I haven't been able to sort of back up. I either back up to try and get more spacious, or I'll actually come forward and say, yes. You know, I give up. Mm. But there's still that.
Well,
there's still that.
Yeah. I'd look at the wanting.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's tricky. and then look at the heart chakra. And then I try to, in moments of non-fear, that's good, look at non-fear. So moments where you're with some family member where there's a lot of love and compassion, look at the heart then. What does the heart feel like there? And, oh, this is non-fear, right? So that, and then how does it change? How does it change into anxiety? Where's in this center? And keep getting good at that area. And then also, in situations which are not threatening, that's very important, when you know the fear is maybe a social fear rather than a biological fear or whatever, and you feel safe, and then see kind of like, okay, what do I want now? That kind of investigation into wanting and not wanting. That's very hard, that, you know, it's like you said, it's tricky.
What do you mean by biological? I mean, I get in it fairly consistently where feeling safe is a infrequent, except like now I feel so safe this whole day. But when I go home is when I feel unsafe.
So the causes and conditions for that we don't know.
No.
You know, they're coming from other environmental situations or whatever. So do a retreat and go for fear. Really, it's if you don't feel safe, you're not gonna do this exercise, right? You're not gonna do it. So, and then who knows how that fear has been conditioned into consciousness, you know, through different kind of factors, and then all the signs and factors are ones which stimulate the fear. It's sort of beyond logic, right? It's not really really logical. The heart chakra is good, you know. I use a lot of the ideas around non-aversion, non-fear, because the heart has that too, right? And non-aversion feels this way. So then when aversion arises, I feel it in my guts or in my body. So kind of just becoming conscious of the places of safety or wellness will give you more chance to notice when the arising of the tightness or contraction comes, and you get more and more sustained awareness on arising. So usually, like in the way of habits, is you don't notice the arising, you're in the soup, right? And then you're in the soup and you struggle with it, and then you might notice the cessation. But oftentimes you don't even notice that. You don't even notice, actually, I'm not afraid now. You're just sort of in it. So that's one thing you want to know. So this is non-fear. Non-fear feels this way. Not trying to get rid of it. And then that makes your awareness more sustained for longer periods of time. And then you get better at noticing the rising with the thoughts or whatever. As soon as you get thoughts of anxiety coming up, say, okay, fear feels this way. Right away, first thought. And then the heart chakra, I would say. Then you can be met above, and that's very good. You know, may all beings be well, may all beings be free from suffering. But now it's a way of getting rid of it. And that's the trouble with metta bhavana. We use it as aversion. It's perverse. I would be metta bhavana if you drop dead. You never come into my life again. But that's it's not Buddhist practice. Just the area here.
Just to keep going to this.
Yeah, that area is very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what it's about, but whatever you define it, yogic or non-yogic, it's alive in there. And so when you feel gratitude or when you feel connection to like a child and you see the child happy, oh yeah, go there. Rather than just enjoy the child's presence, as it were, say, oh yeah, that's what the open heart feels like, right? And then as it contracts, it also is registering there. And you start to see what's happening and get some kind of insights around that. But, you know, if you think right now that say 90% of your suffering is fear, then you sort this one out, then 90% of your work's done. Bus. True, it's really. Because rather than, like, you know, the Buddhism sometimes has the ideas of attainment, which to me is an acquisitive idea. But also has the idea of greed ceasing in the mind, hatred ceasing in the mind, delusion ceasing in the mind. That's one of the ways they define nirvana, the cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion. And that's something you can realize. The attainment bit is a bit tricky because you're trying to get something you don't even know what it is. Dodgy. But this bit you can see. And you can see it not as a final product, but as an everyday occurrence. Now in greed, when you don't want, now in hatred, you can see that, oh, that's close to the goal, right there. So it's much more approachable, I think. Dual. Yes, please.
And I was just wanting to talk a little bit about actually on your spiritual path, and I know that you do monk, and I don't, but I have been on a spiritual path, and I keep being called to
The fact that you're reflecting on this is the key, right? So it's a conundrum, and it's been around for a while. So if you have the opportunity to teach, if it's presented to you, obviously, then if you don't take it, don't take the opportunity. Look at the self-view that's created there. So let's say you're going to give the talk tomorrow at 3 o'clock. No, we'll put your names in a hat. We can all do the same practice. But no, let's say that you know, you have a little doorway. You know, 3 or 4 people, and you have a chance to teach. And then you have that conundrum. So obviously it'd be nice if you could choose to just step in, dip your toes in, and have a look. But if you can't, then having refused that, go back to your cushion and look at what that feels like before you create a self around it. Before creating the argument that I should or I shouldn't teach, just get in touch with what's this feel like now, having not done something that I think I should do. And just wait and see what that brings forth. Because the narrative is usually on self, me and other, right? But I think if you get in touch with whatever that is, then it'll become conscious, and in that becoming conscious, something is learned, which is not just the old narrative, not the old storyline, something new. And something new can only arise if you're available. As long as you're in thought, in that kind of narrative thought, you're not available to the new. So when you're preoccupied with self-thinking, you're not available. So now, rather than, you know, choosing now what you're going to choose, you could say, well, I'm going to choose, and don't worry about it. And then don't choose, right? But then if you don't choose, then become available to the result of not choosing. And just, like, give yourself time, sit down in a cushion, say, okay, what's this really feel like? What is this? And let that inform you, rather than your preconceived notions of who I am, who I should be, and whatever. And keep doing that. And then if you do give a talk, then of course, and it's the same thing, this is what terror feels like or whatever. And then having given a talk, then give yourself time to just notice what the result is. Self-criticism or whatever feels this way. So you become available to the process of your own experience, and that availability is itself stillness, right? That's the key, actually. It's not whether you do it or not. That's the key, because that availability then allows karma to come forth. You respond or don't respond, and you see the result. And you make more and more choices from a sense of intuition rather than a me should do whatever, right? So you've got a kind of pathway to play with it rather than it being yes or no, black and white, like it. Yeah? Bonne chance. Any other thoughts? Yes, sir.
Reading this morning about dispassion, and one of the things that comes to mind immediately, well, two things, is it can sound bleak.
Dispassion, yeah, okay, yeah.
And then also, you'll hear advice like, but you must develop passion for the past. So, maybe speak
right
to what they mean by developing dispassion in regards to bleakness. And
yeah, you terrified me, really. Wet blanket kind of teaching. You know, you're happy. I saw that. It's changing. So passion usually means the way I look at it is the project is the understanding that in the changing objective experience of life you can't find anything stable, right? And that seeking something stable within that is like looking for a turtle with a mustache. You're not going to find it. Right? That's the basic project. And in Theravada we call it attachment to the khandhas. Right? So the mind is searching for an objective experience which is fulfilling and satisfying. It looks for it, gets it, loses it, gets it, losing it. So the sense of dispassion is more just knowing that. Knowing that in what did I have for a drink? It was a double coffee.
Double latte.
There is not Nibbana. But it was good. And I'm awake. But you don't get that, right? And there's only like salt water or something. And then my mind feels disappointed. Oh, I say, oh yeah, expectation feels this way, disappointment feels this way. So my investment in happiness is not in the objects, but in the knowing of objects and changing that. And I can still enjoy life. I can still go on a kayak trip and have a swim in the beautiful, cold, salty water when it's hot and feel pleasure, right? But pleasure is not my goal. Now, If you take dispassion as being something that where you think you're never going to have any pleasure, but that's not life. Pleasure and pain are just part of having a sense experience. And then having passion for the path, it's Chanda, that means like you're really interested in the unconditioned. So for me at least, that language that the Buddha presents to us, if they were not the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginal, the unformed, there would be no liberation or release from the conditioned, the formed, the born, from birth and death. And that model is very important for me, because my passion, my vocation towards science is directed by that. And yet, there is the form, there is the condition, there is comfort, there is discomfort, and I can live in that way where I can appreciate it and be grateful for it. So this passion, I don't use that word much. I use more like the words around craving and becoming, and I use attachment a lot, that non-grasping of the khandhas. So I think, do you have a good background in Theravada? Poco. Well, that's good to study that. So if you're going to study something, understand why they use the word dispassion, right? That's maybe one of the problems. If you don't have a good intellectual structure around why the Buddha taught dispassion and where he's coming from, then you can just take it in the context of some kind of repressive idea, right? It's bad to enjoy your coffee. You know, like it's evil, or something. And then you get really messed up that way. So the idea in Theravada Buddhism is that which has a nature to arise is a nature to cease, and it cannot be relied upon. right? And it's dualistic, happiness and unhappiness. But then there is the uncreated, the unconditioned, the nirvana. And if that is the inclination, then the inclination to get passionate about things which change falls away. We don't make such a big deal out of them, right? But it's not about, it's not a negation of life. That's one of the misunderstandings. It's just the worldly realm is the worldly realm. It has comfort and so on. But within that, like now I'm 71 years old and I need a lot more comfort. But if I don't have it, I'm on a kayak trip. I certainly can adapt and not complain, I think. But when I give me comfort, I'll sleep better. I'll be able to meditate better, which is fine that way. But I imagine death is going to, dying is going to be a bit uncomfortable. Probably. A bit messy. So then if my refuge has been an awareness of discomfort, dying can be okay. Discomfort can be okay. I mean, that sounds a bit flippant, I know. A bit. Can be a boyfriend, right? But you can see the principle, right? The principle of knowing comfort and discomfort and finding peace within those and yet taking care of the body. It's okay to be kind to the body, to care for it in a way which is kind, and so on. Or like art, say art, for me, art can be very calming if I'm interested in like art for me is beauty for me, if it's spiritual, the object points to the knowing. That's to me the sense of awe. Like I always say, they ruined that word, awe. It's awesome. Such a good word, and now it's so trivialized. But, what did it used to mean? I think it meant the silence of the mind. So you look at a piece of work, sculpture, and then the mind goes silent. Now, if I want to own that piece of sculpture and get a copy of it and so on, then I think it's the object, and that's idolatry. I idolize the art. But if I see the beauty points back to the knowing, and that's what I think Cortez Island does, in the water of desolation sound, it points back to the stillness of being. And then, if I understand that, then I go, and I'm in a traffic jam in Toronto on the 401, is the stillness not the same? It's more difficult. Because the water is not there, and the rocks are not there. So you want to be careful with that, that language. And if you understand the sources, it's pretty easy to decipher. If you don't understand the sources, then it can be a bit confusing. So it's not repressive or negating, it's understanding. Yeah, does that help? Yeah, okay, good. Yes, in the back. Right.
And then I have extracurriculars. And then by the time I get home, I'm just eating food and then walking my dog and then going to bed.
Because you're tired, yeah.
So I never really have time to fit in things like mindfulness or meditation, usually, or on a regular basis.
Uh-huh.
Is there any way you could recommend to how to maybe still fit in those things?
Are you on Facebook?
No.
Good. Are you on Instagram? Okay. How much time do you spend on devices? Like in a day? Can you take 15 minutes of that? Like, can you time yourself and put a timer on devices and take off 15 minutes? And then use that to look at your craving for devices. No, seriously, if you get that, your generation, if you suss that out, you'll be the strongest guy on the block, really. Because that is the great challenge of your generation, is this mind going out into objects, right? And what we're doing is we're coming home and being free from the need to go into objects. So if you can look at that pattern and understand it, you'll be able to help your mates a lot. So be careful to say, I don't have time. Be honest and say, how do I use my time? And then prioritize how you might use your time. But you know, you have a good aspiration. You know, you want to understand your mind. These are beautiful things, and if you can cultivate that, then stick with it because it pays dividends. it's a good investment in time, huh? Really good. I've got a, how old are you?
14.
We have a novice who's 18 from Michigan. He gave up listening to music when he was 12. Can you imagine? Teenager not listening to music? And he never went on social media. And he's a really, really together guy. Well, still he does, but he says it's rare. It's a very, very rare thing. Good for you. Yes, please, yes.
I have a 27-year-old son.
Mm-hmm.
I raised him as a single mom once he was two.
Right.
And I just wonder how to strengthen relationships because of divorce. You know, because he always went towards the material and I didn't have that to offer him. I had time.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have like his dinner, you know, once a month. And I usually refuse to pay for his alcoholic
beverages
because I'm against that. Mm-hmm. But I pay for his food. I invite him for dinner. And he's a beautiful young man, and I love him dearly, but I feel I don't get to see him. It's my heart hurts.
Right.
Like, the relationship is just, it's a pain for me, like, to see him because I'm suffering, because I text him.
Uh-huh.
I got a phone, like, I didn't have one on for, you know, like, I just got one 2 years ago, so I'm just learning how to use this little phone and its computer, but I'm not really into it. But everyone is so dependent on it, so I think I have to have one. But it's quite a source of I don't like I took my battery out today. I love it when I take my battery out. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not something I really like. It's just something I think I have to have because of society.
Well, with your son, I would say he's 27. And 27 year old sons aren't interested in your mom.
No.
It's just the nature of the beast, sorry.
Okay.
You know, I'd like to give you a better answer, but it's just, you know, at 27 I wasn't interested in mom. It took me a few years. It's not that I didn't love her, I didn't care for her, but I had to find my own way.
Oh, he does, but I
text him. Yeah, let me finish. Okay, so your expectation of your son hanging out with you, you can look at that and see that that's what you want, and that suffering is not his activity, it's your wanting that's the problem. If you don't take responsibility for that, then you'll always be dependent on him for your happiness, and you'll always suffer. So you have to look at your own need, right, within your heart of wanting to be with him, which is natural. I'm not saying it's unnatural, and it's beautiful in some way, but taking responsibility for that means, oh, this is what it feels like not to have my boy with me. I want him to be, this is what unfulfilled wanting feels like, and you have to hold that for a long time. Otherwise, you'll always be the subject of this wanting energy. If you can hold the feeling of unfulfilled wanting for periods of time, make that conscious, and it comes up in the consciousness, it pains you dearly, but then it starts to cease. And it comes again. If you keep doing that, you find a place in your heart which is free from the need to be with your son. When he then comes into your orbit again, you are much more available to him rather than needy of him. Because you don't need him, and you're more available, he wants to be with you more. Because he wants to be with you more, he'll be with you more. But if you exhibit a very, very strong need to be with him, he'll find that difficult, right? Because he's a man. Right? He's trying to be a man, trying to figure out how to be a man, and so on. And this is, again, I've not been a parent. This is all from conjecture. But this is the vehicle of parent as opposed to vehicle of monk. And so in the vehicle of parent, there's a lot of pain. You know, I see parents, they want so little from their kids. It amazes me. You know, just a little bit of gratitude. I'm astounded at how little they want, right? So this is the pain of separation from someone you love, and not being with someone you love, and someone you love dearly. And Buddha Samhita tries to ask us to make conscious of that pain and see that the awareness of that is the way out, not through the constant stimulation of that through external forces, which is a kind of dependency. It's more through the awareness, oh, this hurts. This really hurts, and hurt feels this way. And then you come to the stillness of awareness. It's not easy.
The relationships are quite painful.
Yeah. But there you go. Again, that's theory. Yeah. Please, yes. Please do. You probably have more experience. Is that right, huh?
Time to go home. Why? And I go, because I want some time to myself. I want the TV.
Yeah.
And he's constantly trying to come back, and I'm wondering what I do about child that's TV.
So that's the opposite. Like I said, I don't do parent. Thank you.
Around their house, and I think, am I crazy or what? Like, I drive around. That's my vehicle.
No, that's not your vehicle. That's not a good idea.
Not a good idea.
I mean, stay home and meditate. Go to a group, meditate, learn how to be silent.
Huh? That's when I started meditating, was when he moved out.
Yeah, do it more.
More.
Please. Any other questions? One more, yeah. Inflicted artificially. It wasn't self-mortification. It was just a society which was very poor, and my intestinal system wasn't used to coarse food. It was used to refined food. It wasn't used to the diet. So, the lay people were giving their very, very best, and all the monks were fine, the indigenous monks. So my body just had to learn how to be with that. And then with the pain of like sitting and so on, I could leave any time. So although it sounds maybe like self-mortification, it wasn't. It was actually a very kind atmosphere, very caring. I wouldn't say I was very caring in that way. But it was good for me. You know, I was a young guy, and it brought up loneliness. You know, how can, you know, just enjoy a bit. Because the men that I was meditating with, the monks, were really strong. They were farming people. They had a lot of endurance. They didn't complain. They could do with very, very little. Where I was quite a spoiled kind of guy, you know, that I could just, you want it kind of thing. And that was really good for the manliness, you know. But the manliness wasn't macho. It wasn't like, I can outsit you, you know. It wasn't that. It was more like manly in a good way, because the gentleness came in our relationship to each other, of respect and deference to seniority, of the way we cared for our teacher, the way we spoke to each other, and our body movement was all actually very refined. But there was also a sense of pride and honor and manliness, and don't move. Endure it. Learn how to endure. And that was very good for me, because I didn't have to do that. I never had to do that. So it was very, very formative for me, in I feel, a very good way. But it was never, you know, like a kind of strong egotism around that, just never manifested, because it wasn't that culture. It was a culture of humility and quietness. And quite often the most ascetic monks were very quiet, and very gentle, but they had a strength. There was one monk I remember, I called him Mellow Yellow. His outward form was very soft, but inward he was so strong. And I really admired that sense of refinement and gentility, but this kind of deep strength inside. It's nice. They're nice models for me. Nice kind of role models. And Ajahn Chah, of course, was exceptional. So it wasn't self-mortification. I might have interpreted it as self-mortification, certainly. I certainly pushed myself to extremes, but that was always my doing. It was always something, you know, coming from my own. We were all like at one in a chat. There was myself, Ajahn Pasama, Ajahn Tiradhammo, Ajahn Brahm, all these Ajahns. And we're all quite competitive. You know, this kind of Western trip, who's going to get in line first? So Ajahn Sumedho once giving the earthworm talk. You guys are going to be arahants, just be an earthworm. Just slowly, slowly, make more soil. So yeah, there's all kinds of things like that going on, but it was never encouraged, you know, always the gentleness and kindness and that were encouraged. Not that I was always, you know, gentle and kind, but it wasn't like a male standard of aggression and competition, which was encouraged. But yet we are men. So how do you deal with that man and your energy and refine it? So in lay life, a man refines energy through relationship, through children, those kinds of things. In a monastery, we don't have those relationships with children, so we have to learn how to refine that energy in a different way. So we do it through samadhi, through that, but also in the caring of our teacher, like just washing Ajahn Chah's feet. Oh, it was so nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these lovely little feet you could wash. and you know, that those kinds of things, yeah. Shall we take a break? Yeah? Oh, please, yes, please do.
I just have two questions.
Please.
Your book, which is online,
yes.
Very nice. You mentioned the aesthetic sect in Thailand.
Mm-hmm. Well, in nowadays,
the white robes or the
no, it's us.
Okay.
It's the brown guys. But but if you just think about any tradition, whether it's a yoga tradition or a Christian mystic tradition or a Sufi tradition, before the use of printed matter or now recorded things, the only way you could really receive teaching was handed down through teacher to student, teacher to student. So that's the oral tradition, which has been the only way we could really do it. And so in modern Buddhism, now you have the oral tradition actually being put to paper. So that book of mine, I didn't write it, I spoke it, and then editors created the book around that.
Right, but I think in it you alluded to kind of a sort of separate tradition of Buddhism, and that you
I don't think so. I don't think I would have said that. Yeah. And what I might have said is that teachers like Ajahn Chah, my teacher, are lost to history because no one recorded it. But there is a continuous giving of Dharma from generation to generation, which isn't esoteric, it's experiential. Right? So the experience of meditation enlightenment is realized by one monk or layperson or whoever, and then passes on to the next. But I don't think I implied an esotericism or anything like that, secret doctrine, because that I don't really believe in that. Yeah, have a look, and if it is, then send me the quote, and I'll have to. What have you been?
Also, you mentioned suchness.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Suchness is a tata, the Buddha often referred to himself apparently as the Tathagata, the such realized. So one way of talking about truth is the suchness of the present moment. So this present moment is such, it's like this. And I could define it as being peaceful, not peaceful, hot, cold, but those definitions come after the fact, right? Because they're thought. Before I think about it, suchness is, it's like this. And the mind is quiet. And it's Dharma. And then I create on top of that, liking and disliking, and then attachment to craving, and so on and so forth. So that's when I try to, when I seek my refuge in the conditions, then I get caught up in liking and disliking, attachment, grasping. But when I just realize suchness, and the awareness of suchness, like this, life is like this, then if I wait, then I say, yeah, there's the stillness, always here now. And so such realized, or such knowing, is simply the awakened mind. Right? And because in the definition of it is always a definition, so you have these rather odd words. But it's pointing to something, right? You're pointing to something. How are we doing for time? What's the, we go till 4:30? Yep. How about like taking a 5-minute break, getting some air, and then we could sit with a half hour, finish with a half hour sitting? Yeah? Okay, let's do that.